Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hey Jim, I want to start today with a quick mention of the IMF's meetings currently taking place in Washington, D.C. They are set piece economic policy events, very important ones that happen twice a year. And at each meeting, new IMF forecasts for the world economy are released. And from our perspective, it's been gratifying to see the IMF recognize what we've been saying all year, which is that global growth led by the US is going to be stronger than previously forecast. So on the usual caveat that the IMF is a lagging indicator, if not a contrarian indicator, of where economies are going, I'd say that we're probably, for that slightly flaky reason and for some others, probably I think now at the peak of that change in sentiment, if you like, moving in line with what you and I have been saying. And I don't think there's going to be much better news on growth going forward. The IMF has recognized it. Other forecasts have recognized it. The all-important bond market and interest rate market has recognized it. So I think it's time to have a rethink, maybe even draw a line under that theme that we've been pushing, which is that growth is going to come in faster than expected, and say it's happened. It's now in the past rather than in the future. And try to have a think about what might happen next. And for all sorts of reasons, I do think it's in the past now. We've had 3, 4, maybe 5 months of better economic news. I think at best the news is going to come in line with expectations for the next few months and could even be a little bit weaker than expected now that those expectations have caught up to that positive growth story reality thing. So I'll come back to that theme when you and I have our traditional row about the outlook for US interest rates. But let's park that for now. And I wanted to ask you about some data this week, which I think is really interesting because it's such an outlier in a global sense, really. And that's Irish house prices.
Yeah. Okay. I'll first just make reference to the IMF during the week. They use the term that I used many years ago that I will never be allowed to forget, soft landing. They're talking about a soft landing for the global economy.
They are a contrary indicator, Jim.
Exactly. But they do point out that there is less economic scarring from the crises of the past 4 years than they would have expected, even though they stress that low-income developing countries have more scarring. And they're it's a pretty upbeat, pretty positive, you know, inflation certainly moving in the right direction and all the rest. So we'll get back to that in the context of the United States. But yesterday we got Irish house price data. And if you think back, Chris, to sort of last September, October, November, those podcasts we did at that stage, I think we were talking about the Irish house prices reaccelerating again. And indeed, that's it. And I was certainly picking that up anecdotally. And the data is certainly catching up with that view of the world now. The latest data show national average house prices increased by 0.3% on the month, up 6.1% year on year. Dublin prices up 0.4% during the month, up 5.6% year on year. And outside of Dublin, up 0.3% in the month. And the annual rate is running at 6.5%. So the market is accelerating quite rapidly. And to put this in some sort of historical context, national average house prices are currently 8.5% above the peak that was achieved in April 2007 before the crash. Dublin prices are still 2.6% lower than the February 2007 peak. And outside of Dublin, and I think this is really interesting, house prices are 9.1% above the May 2007 peak.
So why is the non-Dublin house price doing so well, relatively speaking?
There's a few reasons. Dublin has priced a lot of people out of the market. So there are a lot of people actually moving out of Dublin, buying property outside of Dublin. And of course, COVID and working from home has exacerbated that trend. But definitely, house buyers are voting with their feet. And I'm hearing from estate agents. And as you know, Chris, my approach to analysing the Irish economy, I depend a lot on sort of anecdotal stuff. I talk to lots of different people in different sectors of the economy, but I'm certainly picking up from estate agents around the country that there's a lot of Dublin buyers in the market. And I think about my hometown, Dungarvan. A lot of Dubs have bought property down there over recent months. So there are all those factors at play. But, you know, the bottom line is that for a lot of people, the type of mortgage they would require to buy the average property in Dublin is just beyond either what they can afford or what they're prepared to accept. So it's an interesting phenomenon, but it just shows you that the demand supply imbalance in the market is still very, very real. And I've been reading pieces on the housing market generally, domestic house prices, international house prices, and yeah, and we've discussed this before. There are still people out there who believe that increasing housing supply will not bring house price inflation down. Where do you stand on that?
Well, as you know, I've been on a bit of a journey with that one, in that I was persuaded a while back by a prominent Bank of England piece of research that said it's all interest rates, that you can explain the history of house prices in terms of movements in interest rates, and that supply and demand are much weaker drivers of, or supply at least is much weaker. And I know that offends people's intuition. It certainly offended yours, I remember. And I think I probably come around to your point of view, which is to say that all of these things are important. And the importance that these factors have, whether it's supply, whether it's demand, whether it's interest rates or whatever, varies through time and across countries. And it's quite clear that the drivers of house prices in Ireland are clearly the fantastically successful economy, driven mostly by the international sector, and lack of supply. The situation that you've just described there for Dublin versus the rest of the country, that's actually true in the UK as well, because there's an article in the FT today about how London house prices are really struggling relative to the rest of the country, and are in fact, relatively speaking, weaker than Dublin prices compared to the rest of the country, for the reasons that you just suggested, is that they just got so expensive that people can't afford them anymore. And so people are buying elsewhere and they're not buying in London. So it's interesting to see that story replicated across the two jurisdictions that we are sitting in. So yeah, different people have different views on what drives house prices, Jim. And I think the answer is it all depends. There's no one size fits all answer. I think sometimes you can say it's interest rates. Sometimes you can just say it's the state of the economy. If either the UK or Ireland was to suddenly go into recession now, no matter what interest rates, no matter what supply was doing, I think you'd have a big impact on house prices, for example. So it's a kind of a horses for courses answer to your question. So I don't think it's always supply. I don't think it's always interest rates. It's often a combination of the two, and it depends where you are in the cycle. So I think you just need to be very careful about simplistic sloganizing as some people do, not us, about what is causing what, and to admit your uncertainty, and to say that it's often the case that you don't know for ages what actually has been going on. Sometimes it's pure speculation, Jim. And you know that housing sometimes is just regarded as one of those financial assets, and it starts behaving like, dare I say, Bitcoin. I won't ask you about that. Well, I will, but a bit later. And that people end up, you know, we know that during one of the previous housing manias in Ireland, people weren't just buying up second and third properties in Ireland. They were going overseas. They were borrowing huge amounts of money to buy properties in weird places like Hungary and Romania, and not just France, Spain, and Italy, the usual destinations. So it's complicated. But I do think that Ireland is a standout now for its house price rise. And the thing that really, I think, stands out from that is what on earth's going to happen when interest rates start to fall?
Mm.
I mean, if we had in Ireland our own independent monetary policy, the central bank would be putting interest rates up, wouldn't they? Yeah,
they would indeed. Absolutely.
So monetary policy is completely inappropriate for Ireland. These are the sorts of things that we warned about way back in the day, Jim, before the euro was a glimmer in the minds of the various protagonists. Jacques Delors, wasn't it? He was the father of the euro. Yeah, before he started even pushing it, we warned that if Europe went ahead with this, that they potentially could be real monetary policy problems for those countries that got the monetary policy that they just didn't need. And Ireland is about to get it, isn't it?
Yeah, I remember in the mid-90s being asked by the then CEO of Bank of Ireland to, I'd been making a lot of noise about the economic problems around EMU. And as you had when you were working with me, but you had moved on at this stage. But the CEO called me one day and said, listen, you're making a lot of noise about EMU. I want you to prepare a paper for the board, examining the issues you're talking about. And I remember going into work on a Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and Easter Sunday, writing that paper. And I still have it. And I'm still very proud of it, actually, because it was spelling out a lot of these issues. And I guess one of my main theses at the time was that the Irish political system would be incapable of managing an economy fiscally, using fiscal policy, once it lost control of interest rate policy. And that's exactly what has happened. And, you know, we're, as you say now, God knows what's going to happen to Irish house prices when interest rates start to rise.
Fall. We want them to rise, but they are going to fall.
Exactly. Yeah, sorry. I on that supply issue, I had a conversation in recent weeks with the CEO of one of the major property development companies in this country, who said to me that he hears people saying that we don't have the capacity here to build 40, 50, 60,000 houses. He described that as bullshit. He just said that if the conditions were right in terms of planning and so on, that he would just allocate a large proportion of his staff into building houses. So I thought that was very interesting, and it brings me back to something we've discussed, and I've been really frustrated over the last 4 or 5 years about the lack of urgency of government in addressing the housing issue. Okay, they'll say, you know, we are making progress. We built over 30,000.
Which, in fairness, they are.
So they are making progress, but a lot more progress is required.
So you adopt the Nike approach, just do it.
Exactly, mm. Yeah.
But anyway, perhaps just a little bit lazy, or maybe it's on it. Maybe they honestly believe that the capacity isn't there to build 60, 70, 80,000 a year. But what you're saying there from your conversation with your property developer friend is that we need to revisit that conventional wisdom. And I think that's a really fascinating point, and is worth, on a different occasion, taking a deeper dive into, because I think a lot of people believe the capacity isn't there. And if the suggestion is that if we just put our mind to it, we would find that capacity. Do you know what, Jim? I have a lot of sympathy for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, and what actually kind of, I think, strengthens that view in my mind is the fact that office development at the moment, you know, there's still a lot of it going on here in Dublin, but
you wouldn't exactly be devoting a lot of resources to developing offices at the minute, given what's happened in the commercial property market and so on. So
maybe the resources are becoming available via that route.
Maybe they are, absolutely. And that's why it is essential that the policy backdrop for building houses is made as favourable as possible. And the planning process, as we've often discussed, is a key part of that. So, one can only hope that this does come to fruition at some stage. And one also has to hope that Sinn Féin will not be in a position to take the kudos for the eventual recovery in house building in this country.
Because recover it will one way or another. Simply because it has to.
Mm. The other piece of data out of Ireland this week was external trade. We've had many discussions about the vagaries of GDP and the fact that last year the CSO currently estimates that GDP contracted by around 3.2%. And I've explained that that is almost exclusively down to the fact that merchandise exports fell sharply last year, particularly chemical and pharmaceutical exports. And we're seeing the total flip side of that now. First 2 months of the year, exports are up by, these are exports of goods, okay, merchandise, up by 7.9%. Exports to Great Britain up by 4.2%. Exports to the United States up by 33.3%. And the reason why merchandise exports fell so sharply last year was because that post-COVID adjustment in the chemical and pharmaceutical sector primarily, okay? And in the first 2 months of the year, chemical and related products, as they classify it, up by 8.6%, with the medical and pharmaceutical products up by 30.8%. And that growth in that sector is primarily into the United States. So we're starting to see a rebound in that export performance again. I know we should never jump to conclusions based on a couple of months' data, but if this sort of trend continues, I think you will see a pretty hefty GDP growth rate being delivered in this country later this year. Another thing that struck me, and I'd be really interested in your view of this, that imports from Great Britain in the first 2 months of the year are down by 42.7%. And I guess this coincides with the introduction of the new trade restrictions as part of the Brexit process.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
One of the pieces of news that we've had this week is that the next phase of those restrictions, which people have been here in the UK, exporters have been, and importers in particular have been moaning about, have been the checks that are due to be put in place for imports from the EU, including Ireland, into the UK, and they're due imminently. And there's a secret memo that the FT has got its hand on from inside Whitehall, from inside government, saying that for the umpteenth time, they're going to be delayed again because the UK still isn't ready. So it's quite clear that the traded goods sector, particularly for SMEs here in the UK, the bureaucracy around exporting and importing is a complete mess. It might account for that number that you've just explained there. But I do think that smaller companies have really, really, and medium-sized companies have really struggled with Brexit the red tape, the bureaucracy, the uncertainty, the extra costs of filling out all these forms and the threat of more costs coming in. And the reason why I think that they have delayed yet again the next phase of these bureaucratic checks on imports from the EU is because it'll push prices up. And of course, that's toxic at the moment during the cost of living crisis. So the whole Brexit traded goods thing is a mess, as is the whole Brexit thing, quite frankly, Jim. You will be interested to know that yesterday I decided that I was never going to vote Labour again. Never, ever. Because they responded to a document produced by Brussels, by the EU, which is offering the UK a new travel arrangement for younger people. And it includes things like trying to get kids back into the Erasmus scheme for being able to study for a year in another university in another EU country, which went out the window with Brexit, which was a real tragedy for university students here. You know, I know personally lots of young Irish students that have availed of that in Irish universities, moving around the world, actually. And the Labour Party has came out and said, this crosses one of our red lines. It is freedom of movement by the back door, and we will never, ever countenance anything remotely like this. But nevertheless, we will, of course, be taking measures to get closer to the EU and refining these trade arrangements and other arrangements that have been so messed up. Now, the statement, therefore, was completely contradictory. So if you sort of, you know, bite the hand that's trying to feed you, guess what's going to happen? You're saying to the EU, sod off, we don't want these kinds of proposals. And then you say, well, we want proposals to get closer to the EU. It's ridiculous. And the more fundamental, deeper point about freedom of movement and the Labour Party is supposed to represent working people. The greatest gift to the working classes of Europe, including the working classes of the United Kingdom, has been freedom of movement of labour. The ability to go and apply your trade, work anywhere in the EU, is such a precious gift that Brexit has completely messed up for British people. For the Labour Party to say the things that it says about freedom of movement is an absolute disgrace, because they're just pandering to some northern asshole Welsh valley dwelling person that says that they don't like Polish living next door to Polish plumbers, which they never did anyway, is just, it's obscene, quite frankly. And I am, as you can probably tell, thoroughly disgusted, not just with the way Brexit has panned out over the last, gosh, it's nearly 8 years now, Jim, but the Labour Party, the next incoming government's attitude towards it means that it's not going to get any better.
Yes, I was speaking at an event I'm speaking at a lot of events at the moment, as you can gather, but I was speaking at an event and I was asked about Brexit post-Labour government or post the election of a Labour government. And my view was that I felt it would be good, it would be a positive, that the relationship between the EU and the United Kingdom would improve. And what happened yesterday just flies totally in the face of that view. You couldn't make it up. It's mad stuff. And Chris, what does this tell you about the UK political system at the moment? And I know you're deep into Liz Truss's magnificent opus at the moment.
Oh, I'm glad you clarified what I was deep into there. Just I was starting to get extremely worried. No, I have not read the book, but I have listened to several interviews that she's given, podcasts on the BBC, and various other things that she's done, including long articles. The it's been serialized in the Mail, and I haven't bought the Daily Mail. I don't think I could ever lower myself to that. It's extraordinary the way in which she says that there are so many different things that we could have a laugh at, and that we could really have a giggle at Liz Truss's expense. The contradictions, the oxymorons, the sheer logical absurdities of many of the things that she says. You know, she says, I really do think that this is not a time for finger pointing. And then she spends 100,000 words using all fingers and toes to point at whoever she thinks brought her down, which is pretty much everybody apart from Liz Truss. There's no mea culpa. There's no admission of any errors whatsoever. And she blames the Bank of England, the Treasury, the Office for Budget Responsibility, the BBC, the FT, The Economist. They all get blamed for this deep state thing. And the book that you referred to there is called 10 Years to Save the West, written by the only conservative in the room, i.e. Liz Truss. And it's just full of stuff that you would giggle at and as I say, logical absurdities. But the thing that nobody is focusing on, and this is what I think is the answer to your question about what's going to happen once the Labour Party gets in, is that the fundamental point that she makes is right. And I know you didn't expect me to say that. And that the thing that she goes on and on and on about is that Britain doesn't grow anymore. And the reason why there is no money for public services, why nothing works anymore, why the NHS is on its knees, is because the British economy for 15 years has not generated the tax revenues via economic growth that are so necessary to provide all of these public services. In that, she's absolutely right. Of course, she's utterly wrong as to what's caused that low growth. She regards it as the lefties in the deep state and the conspiracy against her. And her policy prescriptions for resolving that growth problem are also wrong. But the fundamental problem of the lack of economic growth is absolutely right. And so the baby is being thrown out with the bathwater here, and everybody's rightly ridiculing her. But ignoring the fundamental point is that the thing that she's saying, the problem that she identifies, is actually right. And Keir Starmer and co. included, they might occasionally pay lip service to the idea of economic growth, but they have got zero, none at all, ideas about how to deliver economic growth. As you and I both know, Jim, it's a very hard thing to do, but at least you've got to try. And in so trying, you have to admit that you've got a problem in the first place and come up with some policies to try and do something about the problem. They don't even really admit the problem. And so I think that the Labour Party is going to be a big disappointment.
Wow, that's kind of depressing, because I thought it was going to be a step back in the right direction.
I hope I'm wrong.
I hope you're wrong, yeah.
The problem that we have as analysts is that Keir Starmer, all he has to do is just go to a beach somewhere, sit under an umbrella and read a nice book for the next 6 months and wait for the election to be called. He doesn't need to do anything else. He really doesn't. He's going to win. So therefore, he doesn't need to say anything. The fact that people like me say I'd like him to say something about policy is neither here nor there. He doesn't have to, because he's going to win. So in a way, it's an unknown quantity. I'm describing it as an idea-free zone, because he doesn't need to come up with ideas, because if he comes up with ideas, the Tory party is going to attack him. But at the same time, the absence of ideas is very, very worrying. The day after the general election, there may be this great opening of this policy book where there will be, you know, a dozen growth initiatives to cure the Britain of the problems that it faces. And I will be the first to cheer and acknowledge I was wrong if that's what he does. But at the moment, there is no indication that they've even thought about these problems, let alone they're going to do anything about them.
Okay. Moving to the Middle East, we've seen a little bit of a response from Israel to the Iranian attack last weekend. Oil prices down today.
Well, they jumped on the news when it came out. They jumped about $3, maybe $4, and they've come all the way back. They were actually about an hour before we began this podcast, a little bit below where they started the day on that news. Now they're about 0.5% up on the day in the chart that I'm looking at here. They're volatile things, so we can't read anything into minute by minute movements. We probably shouldn't read too much into what's happened today. But if you want to read into it, the market is consistent with all of the headlines, all of the analysis that I'm seeing, which is that it was, in that awful term, a calibrated response by Israel. Iranian television have mocked the attack, the retaliation by Israel on or near one of Iran's nuclear facilities, as being essentially being attacked with toys, quadcopters. They're showing pictures of drones with four propellers and mocking Israel, actually. So we'll see. But so far, so good in terms of the very short term. But if you take a step back from this, Jim, it's not good, is it?
No, it's not good. It's not at all. I mean, the increasing discussion we're hearing about WW3 is quite extraordinary. So many people are talking about it. So many podcasts I'm listening to at the moment It is a constant theme now and a very frightening one. So it's not good. No, it's not good. And it really is hard to see how that situation is going to rectify itself without some colossal consequence.
And I thought the other great political development of the week was the fact that US politics, just when we thought it wasn't capable of throwing up any surprises whatsoever, becoming predictable in its nuttiness. The House Speaker, a chap called Mike Johnson that you and I have discussed several times, this man that believes that the Earth was created 6,000 years ago, that Noah took dinosaurs onto the Ark, and a whole host of other crazy wingnut batshit crazy ideas. Did Noah not take dinosaurs? Well, maybe he did. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. I wasn't there at the time, Jim. maybe you have greater insight into these biblical matters than
I do. Dinosaurs, yeah.
Anyway, he's been obeying Trump's orders and not giving Ukraine any money for a number of months now. And the role of the Speaker, he has many roles, but one of them is to decide what actually comes to the floor of the House for a vote. The Senate passed a bill to give Ukraine and Israel a lump of money, $60 billion actually for Ukraine. And Johnson gave an interview to CNN this week in which he said, and this was just astonishing, he gave all the reasons why Ukraine should get the money. And he paid no lip service or any kind of service to why he'd been delaying all of this money. And he said that the reason why he thinks that Ukraine should get this money is that if they don't, Putin is going to march through Europe. He's going to take the Baltics. He's going to take Poland. And in what was just a jaw-dropping quote, he said, "I'd rather send bullets than American boys to Europe." And this, of course, is what Joe Biden and many others have been saying for months. Now, all of a sudden, the Speaker is saying it too. And so I found that just the most extraordinary vault for us. But of course, it means that as we speak, there is hope that sometime over the weekend, a vote for that $60 billion will go through in the House. But there's still a lot of water to flow under the bridge with respect to other wingnuts in the Republican Party in Washington. Jim, did you know that this bill that the Speaker is now all in favor of and wants to pass in the House, he's going to, of course, need Democrats to join, which is an unusual thing in Washington. A Republican congresswoman, who I won't name just in case she starts to sue me, but she's also known as Moscow Meg, appended an amendment to the bill which said that any congressman or woman that votes for this bill, for Speaker Johnson's bill, has to enlist in the Ukraine army. I mean, we are not a serious people, are we? There are, even Putin gets something right occasionally. Xi Jinping gets something right occasionally. And when they say that the West is not a serious entity, it is stuffed full of batshit, wingnut, crazy people. They're right, aren't they?
They are right, actually. They are indeed, yeah. Chris, before we wrap up, US interest rates, the IMF's forecast for the United States economy, growth of 2.7% this year, which is pretty strong. 1.9% next year. I'm not sure why they're calling for growth to decelerate somewhat in the States, because every economic indicator we're looking at the moment is still incredibly positive out of that country. We've had this constant debate now for some time about where US interest rates are going. And I'm really conflicted at the moment, because there's one bit of me that looks at
Jim. You're conflicted because you got it wrong.
Chris, would you ever let me finish, please? I was going to say that when I look at the US economy and increasingly the data we're seeing, it's very hard to argue for an interest rate cut. And that's been the case for some time. And I totally accept that. But I was basing my premise really on the fact that members of the Federal Reserve were telling us they were going to cut rates.
Yeah, and this week the chairman said he probably isn't.
Yes,
and it's a funny way to run the most important economic policy variable that there is, the interest rate. And I think they've got themselves into a terrible tangle now, and that tangle is one that we have spoken about before, which is that if you simply say we're only ever going to respond to incoming data, the data is always going to surprise. others have made the point that the markets this week got themselves into a complete tizzy over US inflation because the number came in a little bit more than expected. And the fact is, going back to all the things that you and I have said about economic forecasts, the right thing to expect from these monthly numbers, any number, is that it's going to surprise you because the forecasts, more often than not, not always, but more often than not, are always going to be wrong. So the fact is that the markets were expecting 0.3 of a percentage increase in the consumer price index on the month in March. And it, guess what? It came in at 0.4. That's because they rounded. The actual number was not 0.4, it was 0.359. So it was a huge 0.059 of a percentage point higher than expected. And there we had frantic market reaction. There's a good article in the FT about all of this today, and it delves into the actual construction of the consumer price index, why it isn't necessarily the best consumer, the best measure of inflation in the United States, and that if you do a proper comparison of inflation in Europe and the United States, they're actually about the same. And this impression that everybody has that inflation is much lower in Europe than the United States is actually wrong. The other thing I'd say to this is that goes back to that point I was making, that the growth story that we've been banging that drum for some time now, I think is close, maybe not there yet, but close to running its course. And that over the next few months, we might be talking about growth being a wee bit more disappointing than exceeding expectations. These things do change. One of the reasons for that is that that's just the way things go. Another is that if you actually think about the level of interest rates and bond yields in the United States and the overall stance of monetary policy. Because we used to think, not too long ago, that the right level, the equilibrium level, as economists call it, of interest rates in the United States was about zero. And that we had all those fears of secular stagnation and all that kind of stuff. Now, because of the positive growth story, we think that the right level of interest rates is higher than zero. We're back to some kind of normal situation. And to be honest, that level is not 5.25%. Whatever you think the right level of interest rates is, it's from an equilibrium neutral point of view, it's a lot lower than 5.25%. And what that tells you is that when you have your interest rates at 5.25% and bond yields quite high, real interest rates higher than they have been for ages, monetary policy is very restrictive in the United States. And so if you were doing it properly, thinking about it in the round in that way, you would be quite keen to have interest rate cuts at the earliest possible opportunity if you were the Fed, because you don't want to make the mistake of being too restrictive for too long, because you have to be forward-looking, not just reactive, which they are just reactive. That's the problem. And the other thing is that I think that they should settle, all things considered, for all of these measurement issues that I hinted at earlier on, for an inflation rate about 3% rather than 2%, which means that I think that they should start to think very soon about cuts and accepting inflation where it is, because I think it's going to stay here. It probably will fall further. So, Jim, this is a watershed day. I've been banging the drum for months now about how I thought the market was getting interest rates wrong in the States, in the sense that markets were expecting too rapid cuts. That view turned out to be right, and the market...
Chris, hang on a second. The debate we were having was quite a binary one. I said the Federal Reserve would cut by the end of the year. You said the Federal Reserve would not cut by the end of the year.
You speak with forked tongue. You were agreeing with the market that there were going to be 6 or 7 rate
cuts. No, I was not.
That was. I think every neutral listener, not just me, would take that from your remarks. Now the market is saying there's only a 50-50 bet that we'll get 2 rate cuts for the rest of the year from the States. So that's why I am claiming vindication. The market has moved from 6 to 7 rate cuts to maybe 2, probably only 1. I think that's an overreaction. That's the change in my view today. And if I was a trader in interest rate and bond markets, I would now be betting that there are going to be more rate cuts than is currently priced in. So that's the way I'm changing my mind, or not changing my mind, but declaring victory in terms of the view that I had, and saying that now this is my new view going forward on the basis of how things have evolved.
Oh, God. Chris, I am not going to admit defeat on this until the FOMC meeting in December ends. Okay?
I think even then you won't admit defeat, will you, Jim?
Listen, Chris, it's good to talk. Hope you have a nice weekend. I'm going to London for the weekend with my two sons, and we're going to see QPR play Preston on Saturday evening. So what an exciting weekend.
Wow, what an appalling vista. Sorry, sorry, I don't think of a different form of words. Enjoy, Jim. Have a great time.
I'm a very sad guy. Good luck.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.